Welcome to University Matters. This is Patricia Camilleri, Director of Communications and Alumni Relations here at the University of Malta. In this series, I will be talking to academic staff about their research projects, their international networks, about their aims and aspirations. I shall also be hearing from staff and students and visitors to campus about the many events that take place here at the University of Malta. Happy to have with me today Professor Charles Briffer. Just a few words about my guest. Professor Briffer is Associate Professor of Maltese in the Department of Translation and Interpreting Studies within the Faculty of Arts here at the University. He studied at here at the University and at Oklahoma State University, and at present he lectures on the theory and practice of translation in a postgraduate course aimed at improving the quality in translation. This course is a practical one for the training of Maltese translators, which leads to an MA by research. So he also tutors on the Masters and BA students as well, specialising in aspects of Maltese and translation. Besides lecturing and tutoring, he takes part in international conferences and often presents papers on translation-related subjects. He's a literary critic and wrote extensively on translation and on stylistic qualities of Maltese literary prose works. He's a member of various associations, including the Poetics and Linguistics Association in the UK, the Commonwealth Examination and Accreditation Bodies, and the Association of Educational Assessment in Europe. He's also a past president of the Accademia Tan Malti and was a member of the National Council of the Maltese Language. Professor Briffer translates both technical and literary works and publishes extensively both in English and in Maltese. I'll just pick a few of the titles of his many publications in connection with the field of translation. One which fascinated me was his very sort of first one, I think, in 1989, White Dipping Sails, a compilation of marine terminology, which was in the Journal of Maltese Studies. Later on, 91, he translated into Maltese Graham Greene's The Power and the Glory, Poteru Gloria. In 2000, he translated the Malta Adlerian Psychology Association's Manual for Teachers in Maltese, which also sounds fascinating. And in 2004, translated into Maltese Francis Ebeye's English novel Requiem, to a Malta fascist. And then 2006, he translated Enid Blyton's books, which we may have time to talk about. And most recently, in 2010, translated Beowulf and The Misfit, and compiled the Dizionario Culturale. All of these latest ones are in print, and I hope we shall be hearing a lot more about them. Welcome, Professor Briffer.
Thanks for inviting me on this program, because you very rarely have an opportunity to explain yourself or some of your ideas anyhow.
Well, yes, this is exactly what this program aims to do. That is to bring out the very valid work that goes on. Obviously, your students hear about it, but you're quite right. Other people perhaps out there don't hear that much about it. To start off with, because obviously it's a huge subject, this, but just to home in for a moment on your latest activities, the translations of Beowulf and the compilation of the Dizionario Culturale. About the latter, what really is the difference between a cultural dictionary and a general one?
The general dictionary normally gives you the current meaning of a term, and obsolete terms are very often laid aside. But the cultural dictionary, which is different from an encyclopedia as well, gives you the meaning within its historical context. So the cultural dictionary draws heavily on other disciplines like sociology, history, religion, psychology, etc. For example, we have the word caraca in Maltese. Today it means an old car or something that's junk, you know. But that meaning you'd find it in a general dictionary. But in a cultural dictionary, you'll find the connection with the Knights of Malta. Caraca, the English term would be carrack, And therefore, you have the description in the cultural dictionary of what this merchant ship looked like, you know, but within its context. In our case, since I'm writing in Malta, it's within the Maltese context. So it's Maltese history that I draw from. There were about 16 carracks in the whole of Europe at that time. The cultural dictionary does not refer, at least my cultural dictionary, does not refer to those others, just the local scene.
And the fact that the caracca was left to break up in the harbour, if I remember correctly.
That's right. And that's what gave us the current meaning, actually, because people very often remember the latest, not how grand it was and what service it gave, not only to the knights but also to the nation. You know, well, its glorious days were over, and poor thing.
The knights would be disappointed to know that their wonderful caracca has ended up in our language.
And what is interesting also is that the link with the Maltese term goes back even before the actual carrack was developed in the Mediterranean, because it is connected with the word harak, the harsh h in Arabic, which is actually found in Maltese, but we don't distinguish between the phonemes of the harsh h and the soft h. We don't distinguish that, but it goes back to the time when there was another sailing ship that used to throw fire, you know, and that's what the harraka, that's where things got actually confused by time, but that's another story.
Well, I mean, if you think we've been talking about this just for a few minutes and all the thousands of words you probably had to look up, it sounds as though you need a couple of lifetimes to do that, not just one. The other was the translation of Beowulf, not this year. Last year we had something on evenings on campus.
That's right, yeah.
And we had a translation evening, which we conducted, if you remember, at in the courtyard at Valletta campus. And there we included a little piece from Beowulf. In fact, I should have asked you to bring Beowulf along. Perhaps you would have read a little bit about from it. It's such a wonderful, iconic poem. I'm not reading it in the original. Probably it's the Anglo-Saxon wouldn't have I wouldn't be able to read it in the original. Now we're reading it in Maltese. What sensation did that give you? Why did you go for Beowulf of all the epic poems?
Yeah, the experience of foreignizing translation is really fascinating. While I was translating it, what I was thinking of was trying to transport the modern mind to another era. Let me elaborate on that. Trying to transport the modern Maltese mind to another era belonging to the north of Europe, because it is Scandinavian in its background, you know. And this transportation, going back over 1,000 years, you know, is what is actually called foreignization. I'm sending the Maltese back in time, you know. The first journey, I did it myself. I went that far, you know, and tried to find the linguistic resources in order to explain that mentality. I can remember, for example, the difficulty of translating mead. How the heck do you translate mead when we don't have that? But anyhow, something that went very close to it, you know, and you've tried to find strategies. So this is really fascination. But the experience of sending your readers on that voyage in time for a different culture, that's the thing that really grips me, you know. It's a heroic age. We've seen it so very often on the screen. But then how about reading it in Maltese? We don't have much. We've got a couple of translations which Victor Schwerep has done, Homer, Virgil, you know, and the epics like that, and that's fine, but not the Nordic epic. This is actually what stimulated me to translate it.
And it is one of the great epic poems, and therefore timeless, really.
Yes.
It doesn't really, yes. It's not a matter of saying, oh, well, it was written in, whenever, 800?
800, well,
they're not sure about it, but
from
anyway.
800.
And it was probably verbally passed on over the
centuries.
The
problem is that we've got a couple of movies on Beowulf, and they are very sensational. I mean, when
I
saw
one specifically,
I was really disappointed because Beowulf is really the period which was actually playing with the pagan characteristics lingering on in a Christian atmosphere, and Beowulf is very much a Christian with some pagan blood in him. You know, and that was left out.
I think just hearing you speak, obviously one's getting a feel of just how complex this area is. I mean, translating anybody who's had to deal in two languages obviously is going to have felt the fact that, you know, we're not dealing with a tool here. We're dealing with culture, with every word that you're saying. You're carrying baggage, cultural baggage with you. There are translations, and we mentioned before the translation of Lestrump, by Oliver Fugiri, of course, and the Misfit.
Yeah.
What are the problematics associated with translating these works in general?
Yeah. Well, let's concentrate on Oliver Fugiri's Lestrump, because I think it's a unique novel in Maltese literature. In that novel, written in Maltese, Frigeri experiments with the use of rhythmic patterns in Maltese, how they convey sense, emotion, and psychology. That's what he does, and translating it into English was easy, because these processes do exist. Well, there's James Joyce, D.H. Lawrence, etc. Okay? And so, what I wanted to do was to export the Maltese writer. You know? As regards strategies, they were there for me to pick. You know? But in that translation, I was actually saying, hey, look, we do have something that's worth reading. And I think translation, in the case of Malta, is what can really encourage the local writer. Because at one point, our society was discussing, after we joined the EU, should we stop writing in Maltese and start writing in English? That would be disastrous, of course. So the solution is, no, let's continue developing our skills in Maltese, and then all we have to do is to translate. In that case, what we have to do is, well, enhance translation as an industry. We already have a department in this university forking out to society professional translators, and most of them, they enjoy their work doing technical translation, but in their free time they enjoy doing literary translation, you know. So like that, I think translation can actually help us in this matter.
And you also have Maltese writers such as Francis Abeyo, who actually wrote originally in English and then got translated into Maltese, which is rather strange.
It is strange, and I think that word strange is really very proper in this context, because what you have over there is you have a Maltese writer writing in English. So Franz Abbe, what he does is, in English, he foreignizes the content of his novels. And then when it comes to translating Franz Abeyer into Maltese, you've got to relocalize what he had foreignized. It's an interesting phenomenon, you know?
Amazing. here, the message I'm getting is that if you're going to do what you're saying, either translation...
You must love it.
Yeah, it's a labor of love.
Absolutely. If you think that you're going to pick up a dictionary and start translating, well, it's better if you go to Adir and start counting the sand grains. It's much more worth it.
And also the quality of the translating is key, because if you are, as you're saying, trying to export somebody like Oliver Frigier, an audience outside of Malta, you're having to do this at so many different levels that the quality of the translation is really has key. I mean, you're obviously got your background, and you're able to do that. And it's not everybody will be able to do that kind of thing.
You're right, and I would love to see some control on translation. By control, I don't mean something dictatorial, of course, but I would prefer to have our serious literature translated into English or any other language by professional translators. By professional translators, I mean those who have a university background. What do I mean? If I'm translating Oliver Frigieri, I must understand Oliver Frigieri. I must know, as a literary critic, who Oliver Frigieri is and what his moods are from one novel to another. Translating Lestrump is different from translating Il Gidba. They are two completely different things. And when it comes to Phil Parliament, Mike Fury, once again, he is a different guy. You know, and when it comes to the latest, like Jasmin at Maiftach, it's a flashback into an idyllic childhood, which is very different from anything that we've read. You know, these require the translator to know first. He must be a real literary critic, and then you move on to translation.
About your lecturing, we have now this Department of Translation and Interpreting Studies, and in which where you give your lectures. And you mentioned in some of the information that you kindly passed on to me before this interview, you mentioned certain terms. I mean, that you lecture on, like, equivalence, correspondence. These are obviously the semantics of your area.
Yeah,
perhaps
you
could describe a little bit what they mean within this translating context.
Very often we start with formal correspondence, where you get a contrastive process of English and Maltese. Okay, and when you discover that the formal correspondence fails, it stops. Okay, then you have to move on to equivalence. Let me give you an example. You see, both English and Maltese have got a system which we call the pronoun system. I, yin, you, and, etc. They exist. Okay, so there is formal correspondence within this, as far as the pronoun concept exists. But when it comes to the realization of that concept, of that grammatical concept, we start varying. And so, English you can be singular and plural. Maltese distinguishes between the singular and the plural. There you are. So there is equivalence. You see, when I say you, referring to you personally, I have to translate it as int. If there are more than just you, If there's somebody else with you, then the you will have to be translated as intom, and that would be equivalence. Once again, which is even more important in English, you've got the third person singular, which is he, she, it, which we don't have. There is no it in Maltese. So what do? As soon as I see it in English, I've got to discover its sex in order to translate it. These are the interesting things that we pass on to the students.
And what about the, for example, contrastive analysis of texts? Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, the contrastive analysis moves into larger units. You compare the phrases, you compare the clauses, you compare the sentences. Okay, and within the sentences, we lead them to distinguish between the main clause and the subordinate clause. You just can't translate a subordinate clause as a main clause, because that could be disastrous in legal Maltese, you know?
Very tricky.
So the aspect of contrastive analysis is a help to the translator in order to translate his text. Sometimes they get, in legal language, they get very long sentences. In fact, the example that I give them is from the laws of Malta, telling parents to remember to send their children to school, otherwise they get a fine. But it's a whole page, one sentence with one whole page. You've got to discover the parts, you've got to analyze it in order to understand it in Maltese or in English, whichever comes first, okay? And then you've got to see what is important, because those which are independent clauses are generally more important to the legislator, and then you've got to translate. The process is complex, and contrastive analysis is something that helps.
Amongst your research areas, of course, you have many areas, but one I'd like to ask you about, because I have heard you speak about it before, and it really is a fascinating, it made me think in a different way, about colour terms.
Yeah.
Where does that fit in? How do you cope with the colour terms?
Well, very often we get problems with colours. Now, this is not a problem with Maltese, but it's an international thing. In the academic world, they usually talk of an 11-category system of colors. And these colors are very common, but not all languages have the colors, all the colors. Just to give an idea, in this 11-category system, they are called basic terms. We've got white, black, red, green, yellow, blue, brown, orange, and gray. The system in Maltese starts by going one layer at a time, and the Semitic layer, that is the earliest layer that we have, or stage if you want, did not include all the 11 items. We only had 8 items, and 2 of them today are considered obsolete. Then there was this second stage in this color system progress in Maltese, which was influenced by the Romance element, and therefore we had the second stage of the color system called the Romance stage. And in that system, we get what was missing from Italian, and we introduce terms like cannella and grease. Then there is the third layer, which is the English layer, that is the new color schemes, like wine. It's not just red, but we do need wine and rust. We need them, so we introduce them. It's a process like that, and it facilitates translation, because if you have, for example, turquoise, that's in Maltese, turquoise, well, you can actually use it, you see? So it's a study of what is happening. To build that, I try to to discuss these terms with and several hardware stores, and each brand had its own color scheme, and that was
sounds frightfully complicated.
Had hundreds of terms.
In the last half minute, literally, have at our disposal. I'm sorry about that. Do tell me about translating Enid Blyton. Must have been such fun.
Yes. Well, it was fun because Enid Blyton was one of my favorite authors when I was in the primary as a boy. And therefore, going back to my childhood years, that was something that I just couldn't miss. But even Enid Blyton presented the translator with some difficulties. For example, the cottage that Enid Blyton uses, it's a two-story building with a sitting room and a fireplace and bedrooms upstairs. And you just can't say cottage is orfa. Oh, for God's sake, orfa is just a room in the country. You know, it's like a hut, really, and not a cottage. This is one of the problems, even when you translate children's books. Another problem was the word snow, for example. It's not just silch, and it's not just borra. Snow, in various parts of the five books that I translated, I had to keep the word snow, because that is how our children in the primary know it. And if you tell them silch, they'll probably go in the refrigerator. And they will never actually imagine that you can have an adventure in it, you know?
Certainly not in the refrigerator.
That's right.
Well, that brings the program to an end. I know we could have gone on a lot longer, perhaps, but we'll have to have another session in the next series.
That's up to you.
Professor Charles Briffa, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's program. I do hope you can join us again next week for another in the series University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.